the Allman Brothers, Melissa. And we put together our list of bumper music earlier in the week, and I had already picked out a different Allman Brothers song to play for tonight. Then we got word that Greg Allman had died at age 69, and we changed it to Melissa, which I thought sort of fit the mood here a little bit better than what I had in mind. I guess you could say his death was not exactly unexpected. I mean, some would say his expiration date had passed a while back because of choices he had made, but still, it hurts all the great music he had produced. I'd got to see him, fortunately, a couple of times in concert as far back as the 1974 in Atlanta, and then more recently here in Las Vegas, and Greg Allman gone. We're talking with Daniel Simone about the Pierre Hotel affair, this incredible robbery. In a moment, we'll hear about the loot that they collected and how it led to the downfall of this gang that put this whole thing together. We'll be right back with more Coast to Coast AM. So in this segment, Daniel, we'll talk about how things sort of go bad for the gang even after they get out of the building with all the loot. But I should point out, as you note in the book, the Pierre Hotel affair, they had some good luck, too, leading up to it. I mean, Bobby Comfort is sort of casing the joint. He walks into the bar of the hotel, and he has a chance encounter with a woman who then whose information becomes sort of key to pulling it off, right?
Yes, it was. She was the assistant bookkeeper who kept track of the items that the guests would keep in the safe in the hotel safe deposit boxes, and of course, part of the information that she recorded was when the guest rented the box, when the box was last accessed, and approximately what sort of items and cash were in each safe deposit boxes. And that was very helpful, so that they didn't waste time breaking into boxes that were empty or boxes that contained nothing of value.
Yeah, that was one of the things that they had not counted on as they get in there and they realize, holy cow, we can't drill all these boxes.
Yes, precisely. But again, because of this good fortune of having had the opportunity to meet the young lady who handled, you know, that particular task, that made it very easy for Nalo to select those boxes that were more lucrative and not waste time with the empty boxes or boxes that did not have anything of value. Because let's bear in mind that they had a time frame of a window frame, rather, of 2.5 hours. They had to vacate the hotel before the 6 a.m. shift would be coming in. And of course, the entire robbery, the siege, I should call it, lasted exactly 2 hours and 40 minutes. And they managed to leave at approximately 15 minutes before 6 a.m. And of course, if they did not have that information that this woman had unwittingly supplied Bobby Comfort, they would not have been able to have had such a great score, because many of the boxes that they would have wasted time breaking into would not have yielded anything of value.
Well, describe the scene in the vault, how they're getting into the boxes and what they're finding.
It was very easy to break into the each individual safe deposit box. They used crowbars and nothing really sophisticated. Once they had the list of what each guest had in each numbered safe deposit box, they targeted those particular boxes, and that made the operation much, much simpler and faster. So they got busy breaking into those targeted boxes, took out whatever was in them, and loaded the loot into three Louis Vuitton luggage. And the reason why they chose Louis Vuitton luggage was to make the stolen merchandise less conspicuous. Because after all, who could possibly imagine that a group of armed robbers would carry their haul inside Louis Vuitton bags?
That's a nice touch.
Every little detail was so carefully planned that it was truly remarkable.
So they start finding just enormous quantities of jewels and cash, right?
Yes.
So describe some of the way they're opening a box. What are they, and in particular, there was one box where Sammy goes too far.
One box that Sammy himself happened to break into contained an 83-carat diamond necklace that the owner had purchased for $780,000. Again, $780,000 would equate to approximately $7 million at present value. And Sammy was tempted to take it for himself, and he did. He slipped it in his pocket. But unfortunately, Bobby Comfort had spied him doing so, but wasn't quite certain if his eyes had deceived him or if, in fact, Sammy Nello did slip something in his pocket. And later, since Sammy Nello had given the... had consigned this valuable necklace to a friend of his who lived in Detroit, and when the friend discovered or suspected that this was stolen merchandise, he turned it into the FBI office in Detroit, and this was the only item that was recovered. However, the owner denied that it was hers, because she feared that she would have to explain to the IRS where she got the money, $780,000, to buy this piece of jewelry. So at first, the owner denied that this was hers. But then through some investigation, the jeweler who had sold it to her confirmed to the investigators that this particular item he did in fact sell to this person who happened to have been a guest at the hotel. And coincidentally, the same woman still lives at the hotel, at the Pierre Hotel, in one of the co-ops that the hotel was ultimately converted to.
So the guys get all this stuff out of these boxes, jewels, stacks of cash, an amazing amount of cash. They stuff it into the Louis Vuitton bags. They get it into the limo. They're about to leave. Two cops come up. They send them down the hallway and lock the place up, and they take off. They go to where their getaway cars are parked, and again, some bad luck happens.
It was a frigid night. It was extremely, extremely cold. And one of the secondary getaway cars didn't start. The battery was frozen. So they had to jump start it with the third getaway car. And while they're doing this, the robber who was pulling the third getaway car nose to nose with the car that wasn't starting pulled an illegal U-turn, and a cop happened to, you know, just be driving past and stopped them. And now, of course, the policeman wanted to know what they were doing, and this created quite some moments of heart-seizing, you know, situation. But Bobby Comfort, with his fine silver tongue, was able to you know, calmed the policeman and explained that they had a situation where they had to attend a breakfast at Columbia University, that they were special guests of this breakfast meeting, and that they were in a hurry. But unfortunately, one of their cars wasn't starting, and somehow he convinced the policeman to walk away, and that's how that ended. And
that's some smooth talking. That's some smooth talking at that time of the morning.
Yes, it was.
Oh, okay. So they get away. They get to a place. They divide up the loot. They start arguing immediately about whose cut is going to be what. That amazed me that they wouldn't have had that figured out, I guess. But then again, they didn't know how much they were going to get.
Correct. That's the amount of the haul surprised them. But what's interesting is that, except for Sammy Nello, Bobby Comfort, and Nick Sacco, the other five robbers were not familiar, were not experts in the field of jewelry and the precious stones and diamonds and so forth. So immediately, Sammy Nello, not realizing that Nick Sacco was as much of an expert in jewelry as he was, downplayed the value of the haul. and said, oh, this looks like it's probably a couple of million dollars at best. But of course, Nick Sacco knew better. And at that point in time, he decided to handpick those particular pieces of jewelry that were the finest and the most desirable and more valuable, and walked away with them. And of course, he left the rest to be divided amongst the others, which they did at a later date. And then other things happened. I don't want to, you know, give away too much of the right. whole story, but it turned in the end, they began killing one another. Greed took in, came into the mix, lust and betrayal, and all those elements that typically come into the play after such a score is realized. And it actually happened.
Describe for me sort of the reaction when the crime is discovered, how big of a story it was, how the police react, because at some point, well, I'll come back to that. They do have some definite suspects in mind, but describe the scene first.
Well, first of all, it's important to mention that as I mentioned earlier, the police commissioner was appalled at the fact that some of his men had actually been on the premises while the robbery was taking place, and no one was, you know, known to it. So there was a bit of a an argument over, you know, why or how is it possible for half a dozen cops not to realize that a crime was underway. But then what happened is that when they started interviewing the captives and the hostages, of course, none of surmising that the robbers may have been mafia connected, the hostages didn't want to cooperate with the investigators. They said that they would not be able to identify them if they were placed in a lineup. And in short, they were very uncooperative. As far as the victims who lost their valuables and cash that they had placed in the safe deposit boxes, many of them denied that they had lost anything at all. Again, how could they explain to the IRS that they had $500,000 in a safe deposit box in a hotel? Or how could they possibly explain having this exorbitant amount of jewelry stored, and how did they purchase it? So for all these reasons, many of the victims who lost a substantial amount of cash and jewelry simply downplayed the value of what they lost, and many even denied that anything at all was taken from them.
And then the people who had been handcuffed and corralled into the, you know, moved around through the whole ordeal for a couple of hours were also basically uncooperative. They said, I don't know what the guys look like. They had disguises on. They wore gloves. So they weren't much help either.
Well, they were afraid that perhaps they were dealing with mafia members, right, and were afraid of reprisals. That was the reason why the hostages were uncooperative. The victims were uncooperative because they didn't want to declare this wealth that they had hidden in the safe deposit boxes. So for all these reasons, the investigators really were stonewalled, and the investigation stalled.
But a huge story, though. It's a media capital of the world, so immediately the Pierre Hotel is swarmed with reporters and camera people.
Yes, absolutely. Not to mention the fact that the Pierre itself, being such a famous landmark and exclusive hotel in itself, drew the immediate attention of the media. And it became a sensational headlines that fascinated the public and entranced the press corps.
So the police are pretty embarrassed by the whole thing. They have a news conference that you describe in detail in the book, the Pierre Hotel Affair, at which they're not able to answer any questions. They fumble it pretty badly. But then they sort of get it together, and they develop a couple of possible suspects based on previous crimes, and it's two of the guys, right?
Yes. First of all, the police department made the mistake of convening a press conference when they had no answers to anything. So that was a tactical error that the NYPD made, and of course the press conference became nothing more than an embarrassment. for the police department. But what happened later is that because of the Sophia Loren robbery, Sammy Nailo was being sought by the FBI. But the FBI did not know Sammy's real name, and of course he was only known as the Arab. An informant evidently tipped off the FBI and told the FBI agents who were investigating the Loren case that someone by the nickname of the Arab was involved in the Loren robbery. And this is really what led the FBI to approach Sammy Nailo once they learned his identity. And of course, at that point in time, the FBI arrested Sammy Nailo, but he didn't confess or did not admit to anything, nor he identified any of his cohorts. And again, the FBI was stonewalled.
Yeah, they get Bobby Comfort because he makes the mistake of coming back to help Sammy the Arab Nailo, who gets into a jackpot because of his bad habits, right?
That's correct, yes. Because of his gambling debts, he was under pressure to liquidate some of his share of the jewels, and Bobby Comfort returns to New York City to help him liquidate some jewels so that he can satisfy the bookmaker to whom he owed a substantial amount of money, Sammy Nailo, that is. And through a coincidence, the fence who was slated to purchase some of the jewels that Nailo wanted to liquidate turned out to be an FBI agent.
Oh, boy.
And this is what caused the arrest of not only Sammy Nailo, but Bobby Comfort as well. But again, neither one of them admitted to any wrongdoing. They didn't confess to anything. They denied any involvement in the Pierre Hotel robbery or the Sophia Loren robbery or any other hotel robbery that they were under suspicion for or being accused of. And that was basically how the entire investigation ended.
So you got to get this giant score, all kinds of cash, untraceable jewels. They divvy it up. They go their separate ways. Bobby Comfort goes home to Rochester. He's like home free. Nick Sacco, you say, he goes down to Florida. He's going to get some sun, and he's playing it smart. They're playing it smart, but because Sammy the Arab Nailo has this this bad gambling habit, he's got this loan shark or bookie who's after him, going to kill him. He has to liquidate some jewels in a hurry. Bobby Comfort comes back to help him. And he gets snared by an FBI informant.
Yes, because the and of course at the meeting where this alleged fence was to purchase some of the jewels that Nailo wanted to liquidate, turns out to be an FBI agent, and consequently the arrests were made. But again, because of their staunch consistent denials, the investigators couldn't really mount a trial. So the FBI abandoned the case for that reason, and they did it because they knew that even if they did secure an indictment against them, but the indictment would not have been upheld by any evidence because they didn't have any evidence. But the NYPD persisted the case and did proceed to indict Bobby Comfort and Sammy Nailo, but of course a bribery was funneled to the presiding judge, and the presiding judge forced the district attorney to allow Bobby Comfort and Sammy Nailo to plead to minor charges, and that's how the whole case investigation
That's a whole other story. Maybe we'll have time to get to that in the next segment. I will, Daniel Simone, I'll try to take some calls. At least we'll see if there's anybody out there who can add a little something to this story, either somebody who knows about the case or related to somebody who is involved in it. If you've got that kind of a call, then feel free to chime in. We're going to take a break now. We'll be right back with more talk about the Pierre Hotel affair with my guest, Daniel Simone, and Dwight Yoakam takes us into the break. That's Mark Cohn, Walking in Memphis. Beautiful song. We're talking with Daniel Simone about his book, The Pierre Hotel Affair, an amazing caper, the story of how this gang pulled off this robbery. And could have gotten away with it, except as things kind of disintegrated. And in a moment, we can take some calls from folks in the audience. If you've got something to bring to the party, you know somebody involved in this, if you were there, have a link to somebody who was a victim, or maybe you work for the police, or you have some kind of connection to the case, we'll take your calls for it. Daniel Simone, who is also the author of the Lufthansa heist, very knowledgeable about these mob-related affairs. I also want to mention, I appreciate you staying up late with us tonight. I know it's Memorial Day tomorrow, and you can stay up late. A lot of you have the day off. It is our most thoughtful national holiday, and I hope all of you enjoy your day off, but also hope that you take a moment to remember what the holiday means and what it stands for and the sacrifices that were made. We'll be right back with Coast to Coast AM. Daniel Simone, let's talk a little bit about the aftermath. I know you don't want to give away the entire story of what happened, but Nick Sacco, does his name ever come up in the investigation? Do they start looking at him as a possible suspect?
In short, George, until my book was published 2 weeks ago, the authorities had no clue as to who was involved in this robbery. They did suspect Sammy Nello and Bobby Comfort, but it was only that, suspicion, because they did not admit or confess to anything. So, no, Nick Sacco's name never came up in respect to the Pierre investigation, but of course he was a reputed, known burglar and jewel thief. He was known to the FBI, he was known to the New York City Police Department, but no one ever knew that he partook in the Pierre robbery.
Wow, so have you had contact from law enforcement since the book came out, now that you're sort of laying it down?
No, because it wouldn't behoove law enforcement to contact me regarding this case. The statutes of limitations have long, long expired. Not to mention the fact that I think it would be to their great embarrassment to call me to ask me as to, you know, what happened in this robbery.
You know, we mentioned a couple of things, some good luck, some bad luck that happened to the gang. So after the event, this almost reminds me of the Goodfellas story, where the character named Stax is supposed to get rid of the vehicle that was used in the big Lufthansa heist. This guy is supposed to get rid of the limo, take it to a place and have it crushed, but he's missing. The other guys are all divvying up the loot, and they can't figure out where this guy is. What happened to him?
Well, returning from the auto wrecking yard after he dropped off the limousine to be built and, to be crushed and built, as I mentioned earlier, I'm returning back to New York City. He was involved in an auto accident, and fortunately, he escaped without any injuries. But he encountered other problems while he absconded from the scene of the accident because he didn't want to be interrogated by the police, who would be responding. But again, I don't want to give away too many details, and I would like for the reader to have some surprises of their own to enjoy and be entertained by.
Yeah, I just was meaning there's a whole bunch of things that have to go wrong for it to end the way it ended. And it's amazing that the serendipity.
Yes, but one of the causations, one of the reasons why things did go wrong for some of the robbers is because when they learned that Sammy Nello had taken that 83-carat diamond necklace for himself, they felt betrayed. They felt cheated. So in retribution to that, they absconded with substantial amount of jewels and cash that they were holding on behalf of Bobby Comfort and Sammy Nello, believing that Bobby Comfort must have also had a hand in taking that 83-carat diamond necklace. So in actuality, in the end, it was Sammy Nello's greed that caused a catapult of problems amongst the eight robbers, and for good reason. It was justified.
You know, this is not complimentary to law enforcement in a couple of ways. One, that they sort of bungled things in the beginning. They recuperated, you know, and zeroed in on some suspects. And then there were two really bad things that happened. You mentioned earlier a judge in a proceeding that we haven't got into in great detail, took a bribe from the mafia, a pretty big bribe. And then in the other part of it is that a detective who was involved in trying to pressure Sammy Nalo into telling what had happened did something as well.
Yes, the detective who was left to guard Sammy Nalo's apartment immediately after the FBI had arrested Sammy Nalo, discovered a substantial amount of jewels in Nalo's apartment, and he pocketed Nalo's jewels rather than turning them into to his superiors.
He probably figured he got away with it too. He was being kind of cool about it and just stashed it away for a while, and then later made a terrible mistake in trying to cash it in. Yeah. We got a couple of callers. A first-time caller, Logan in Houston. Hi, Logan. You're on with Daniel Simone.
Hey, how's it going, y'all?
All right.
I'd just like to thank you, Mr. Simone. I really appreciate you talking about your book. I just purchased it, in fact. I got a great deal. I ordered it off Amazon, and it'll arrive June 2nd. And just thank you for this. This is awesome.
Well, thank you. And I hope you enjoyed the book.
I know I will.
Daniel, I had mentioned that it would make a great movie. You had any talk about that?
Yes. In fact, the book has already been optioned by a production company called Titan Steel Productions in Hollywood. And this production company is quite optimistic and euphoric that hopefully by the early part of 2018, they will have all their ducks in order and possibly begin production adapting the book to a full feature film for theaters.
It feels like a Martin Scorsese film. I know he's a busy guy, but that's the feel of this thing.
Indeed it does, yes.
You said Nick the Cat is in witness protection. Are you able to contact him, or does he contact you, or that's sort of forbidden?
Yes. Nick and I have spoken on a daily basis throughout the development of the manuscript, and we still contact one another. As a matter of fact, I did a book signing event this past Tuesday evening, and at the event, I had Nick call in to take questions from the people who were attending the book signing, and Nick is quite colorful. The audience got a big kick out of him, but we speak frequently. And when I was in the process of developing the project, he and I spoke on a daily basis. I recorded all the conversations I had with him. He was quite helpful, lucid, and very remarkably reliable.
I don't know if he's listening tonight, but if he is, if he ever gets to Las Vegas, have him look me up. And it sounds like an interesting guy. And he is in witness protection. He did not roll over on this case. He didn't spill any secrets. This is something completely unrelated, as you said earlier. Can you get into that or not?
No, because I would rather not take the liberty, not knowing whether Nick would want for me to discuss this publicly or not. Not to mention the fact that he and I have already discussed the possibility that that part of his life, when he did enter the Federal Witness Protection Program and why he was forced to do so, may possibly become a sequel to this book.
Well, let me ask you this. Is it likely that somebody is still looking for him, actively looking for him?
In my opinion, no. In my opinion, but then again, you know, anything is possible. Someone may perhaps, if encountered, someone may possibly want to kill him just for bragging rights. That's always a possibility. But from the practical aspect, based on my findings, based on what I know of this entire situation, I don't believe that anyone is actively looking for him.
You know, the idea that a haul like this can be pulled off, and that just all but one item, it vanished into the wind. I was unaware that the jewels are so untraceable. I mean, you could figure out something as expensive as the items that you're describing that were stolen from these safety deposit boxes, somebody would be able to identify it, even without the help of the owner.
My understanding is that once the stones, the gems are extracted from their settings. It's impossible for anyone to positively identify them.
Wow. And have any of them surfaced anywhere? And no one has, I guess if you had bought it from some fence somewhere, you would not want to admit it, that you had paid money for stolen merchandise.
Other than that 83 carat, the diamond necklace, nothing at all has ever surfaced anywhere or recovered.
The FBI agent you talked about, I mean, he seems to be a straight arrow guy who was working this case. He seems to have stayed on the case for a long time.
Yes, he did. Matt Hammer, his name is. He did stay on the case until it became quite obvious that Sammy Nalo and Bobby Comfort were not going to cave in. They were not going to admit to anything. And there was no other evidence to mount a successful trial against them. And the FBI wisely decided to abandon the case. And they did. But, of course, as I mentioned earlier, the NYPD continued to pursue them in the hope that they would be able to ultimately force Bobby Comfort or Sammy Nail or both of them to cave in and confess to the crime. And, of course, they never did. And the judge, the presiding judge, was bribed by the Lucchese family. And this is how the entire Pierre affair ended.
Matt Hammer, an FBI agent named Matt Hammer. It sounds like he needs a TV series. You say in the book, you mentioned that Bobby Comfort sort of went back to Rochester. He later opened a jewelry store, and that the authorities assumed that when he's going straight and trying to sell jewelry, assuming that everything in the jewelry store must be stolen merchandise.
Yes, that's correct. And they arrest him on a constantly until Bobby Comfort finally decided to throw in the towel and get out of the business completely and retire because he could afford to.
We'll take one other call. East of the Rockies, Doug in New Jersey. Hi, Doug. You're on with Daniel Simone.
Yes. Hi. Good evening, gentlemen. How are you tonight?
Very well. Thank you.
Great. I'm glad to hear it. I don't have nothing to add to the case, but I wanted to give a quick little idea of just exactly how I'm from the state of New Jersey. We are very how should I say ethnically a lot of people here. We have a lot of people from the Mideast and from India and whatnot. I'm not sure if your guests had heard about this or not because it was kept very quiet. It happened in that it started in the mid 90s and it ended in, I believe, 98 or 99. Ladies would go out, these are Indian ladies or Middle East persuasion, and they would start what was almost like a Tupperware club. But what it was for jewelry. And they would bring, you know, they would come. It started out 8, 10, 12 women at a time. They would come to a house. Somebody would come out and break out jewelry, and they would look at it. And if they wanted it, they would order it from the catalog and this and that. And eventually they got up to around 25 or 30 women who were partaking in this. And what they began to do was they would bring in these, they were almost like butlers. And the women, they wanted to show off their jewelry that they had at home and their heirlooms and whatnot. And when they came to these parties, they would have a butler would walk up to them with an armed guard, a security guard, and they would say, while you are having your tea and your biscuits and whatnot, and you're going to go ahead and look at the jewelry that we're going to put on display tonight, while you're here, you put your name on this pouch and put all your jewelry in it, and we have a gentleman downstairs who is cleaning all of the jewelry, and there's no charge to you at the end of the night. You get your jewelry back, and, you know, we hope that, if we're doing business with us, we'll be glad to continually go ahead and clean your jewelry.
I'll tell you what, Doug, let's let Daniel Simone tell us if he's heard anything about this, because we're coming to the end of the show, and this is sort of off the topic.
I didn't, but it sounds like a beautiful scam. But I know I did not hear anything about it.
Thank you, Doug, for the call. I appreciate it. You mentioned earlier, just in passing, that Sammy Nalo's luck ran out. One of the undercurrents throughout this book is him with all this big stuff that's going on, he is still dodging this loan shark or bookmaker. And in the end, it catches up to him. I know you don't want to give away everything, but can you talk about that, how it ends?
I can say something that is quite interesting. When Sammy Nailo met his demise, coincidentally, two different people were had planned to kill him on that same day. The one who got him first just happened to beat the second by a couple of minutes. But there were two people that coincidentally planned to kill him that same day.
Jeez, I guess his number was up.
His number was definitely up.
And well, he brought it.
If one had missed him for whatever reason, the second would have got them.
This guy brought it on himself, though. You know.
Yes.
You also, I mean, there's an extended section in the book that I found really entertaining about two of the guys. We won't go into details about which ones they were from the crew who took off with a big pile of loot and had a really fine time in Europe, just living like kings for a while, but made the mistake of coming back.
Yes, that's absolutely true. They did make, they had a great grand old time in Italy and Holland, womanizing and enjoying the touristic tour of those countries. But of course, when they did return, they too met their fate.
Well, I've enjoyed the book, Daniel Simone. Do you have a next project in mind?
My next project is about Charles Manson. And my collaborator on that project has been Charles Manson.
I don't understand.
Well, in other words, he collaborated with myself and my associate on the project. We have hours and hours of taped conversations with him by telephone. And this is the first project that he has endorsed. In fact, he has signed the first page of the manuscript and placed his thumbprint beneath the signature so that if anyone would doubt that the signature was authentic, his thumbprint authenticates that it was him who actually signed it.
Well, Daniel, you'll have to come back and talk to us when that project gets going.
Yeah, in fact, I would like to mention, if I may, very briefly, that the Reels channel has just completed filming a documentary series based on my manuscript, and the episodes will be broadcast sometime in December of this year. And that's the Reels channel, R-E-E-L-Z.
All right, Daniel Simone, thanks for being back with us. The Pierre Hotel Affair is the book, and it's an excellent read. Appreciate you being here.
It's been my pleasure, George.
All right. And we'll be back in a bit, in a moment. UFOs, Reframing the Debate, with my guests Robbie Graham and Greg Bishop. And we're going into the break now with a song from The Kinks.